You know what? Get over it, because we've got a country to run and that's what I've demanded of them.
I wish ScoMo and Joshy every success.
Government members do not trust each other.
I'm a bit lost for words. That doesn't happen very often. The Wrap.
Because it's Friday night, so what better thing could there be than to talk about all the things that have happened in the past few days? You can contribute 0418 226 576. If anything has caught your fancy, with us to chat this through is Bevan Shields. He's the Canberra Bureau Chief for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, sir.
Hello, Jonathan.
And Elizabeth Koulas, host of the new 7am podcast being put out by the good folk at the Monthly. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
Does this mean 7am every day?
It means late nights, but it does go out at 7am every day. So join us every morning.
I have a vision of you being there from 3am putting this together.
Not quite. It's part of the magic of podcasting, I guess.
That is similar to the magic of radio. But now, Bevan, we've had a flurry of people with new jobs and new opportunities. Other Synodinus as ambassador, that's a prominent one.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always a surprise in ministerial reshuffles, and this was a pretty big one for two reasons, really. One is that Arthur Synodinus is a very respected senator. A lot of people thought he's also a moderate. He's very sensible. He's got a lot of experience. For those reasons, a lot of people are expecting him to come into Scott Morrison's cabinet. There's been a bit of grumbling about Energy Minister Angus Taylor and his performance. That's grumbling from some MPs in the party room, but also people in the industry. Everyone was very unhappy with Melissa Price, who was pretty hapless. A lot of people are expecting Arthur Synodinus to perhaps take this kind of super portfolio of energy and environment, and that would have been a very big deal. That hasn't happened. Morrison has decided instead to pack him up and send him off to Washington. It robs the government of a really good performer, but it's a really smart move, I think, because, you know, US politics at the moment is a total shambles. Australia is very unclear about America's long-term commitment to Asia. There's this worsening trade dispute between China and America that threatens our economy.
Yep.
Having someone there with this experience, these skills, this kind of savvy, this sort of cunning political operator is perfect, perfect appointment. He was actually offered it back in 2005 by John Howard. Arthur was John Howard's chief of staff and he turned it down, and he's been offered it a second time, which I would have to say is probably a first.
Critical moment too in terms of the US political cycle. Yeah. You know, that much will happen in the next couple of years. I mean, Elizabeth, out of all those sort of cabinet kerfuffles, does that strike you as one of the more significant or you know, other issues that have caught your eye?
I think I'm interested to see, of course, Ken Wyatt getting this this appointment as the first Indigenous Australian to have this portfolio of Indigenous affairs. That's interesting and I think very important and a big step forward for us.
Out of the blocks too quickly today with that announcement of a national resting place for remains of Indigenous Australians, some which are scattered to the winds globally and in various institutions. That would be a really significant thing to bring. To bring those people home.
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I wonder now if you're going to jump forward, Jonathan, but I have this week just constantly been thinking about the Uluru Statement from the heart and listening to Ken Wyatt and kind of what he thinks he's going to be able to do in that portfolio. And I've been watching that very closely.
I wasn't going to jump forward that far yet, but I'm going to soon. You just hold that thought.
Sorry.
Well, and tell me what you think too. I mean, pre-election, Elizabeth, we had a lot of talk about the Liberal Party's woman problem. Seven women in the ministry is not bad going, and some interesting promotions in that respect too.
Yeah, Linda Reynolds in particular. I mean, I know she wasn't just promoted in this reshuffle, but I'll be interested to see what she does with the defence portfolio, and it'll be interesting to see how she brings her experience in that area into her work in that position.
I want to go back to Arthur Synodinus because we've got some words here about what he thinks about his opportunity in the US.
I'd been offered Washington once before in 2005 and I didn't take it because I thought I was too young for that sort of role, and there were family considerations as well. But I thought this time, well, I'm not going to get offered this sort of post too often. It's a big post. It's an interesting time to be going.
There you go, Ben. He was listening to you.
I'm glad to have been able to help.
It is it is a big and challenging thing. I mean, we don't hear a lot, I guess, about the work being done by our diplomatic service, but it's not insignificant.
And people have mocked Joe Hockey for taking, you know, some awkward Instagram photos of him on a tennis court and bopping around Washington. But he's done quite a good job, actually, in Washington. He's somehow made himself, got himself into the heart of the White House. He's very close with acting chief of staff. He gets along well with Trump. So there is a lot of work that you don't see. The other amazing thing about...
I wonder what he'll do when he comes back.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, most people think he'll probably go back to the private sector and start to earn some serious money.
Off to the Minerals Council.
Yeah, maybe. But look, the other fascinating thing about this for me is... Arthur Sinodinos nearly died. He was he had cancer. He had to take leave from Malcolm Turnbull's cabinet. He only has recently just returned to Parliament. He's fighting fit. He's healthy. But I mean, I just think, and I don't want to overblow this, but I think it does send a really good message to people who are also battling cancer that at the end of this, there is lots of opportunities. There's lots of fresh starts available. And that's something that's really struck me out of this as well.
And perhaps, Elizabeth, too, a message that, you know, you can get out of your rut. You can take a new opportunity. You don't have to just exhaust yourself in the same thing.
I suppose that's true. And I mean, of course, it does seem like a bit of a loss for a sensible and wonderful voice that I think Sinodinos did bring to debate on the coalition side. But yeah, all the best to him, and it'll be very interesting. Of course, the debate between Trump and Mueller continues in the US, and it is still a very interesting time under that presidency. So it'll be interesting to see what he does with the opportunity later this year.
Now, this time, Elizabeth, I am taking your lead, and we are going to Robert Mueller. Well, he was extraordinary this week, and I mean, choosing his words with care. But what do we learn from his statement to the press?
Well, it's sort of like we learn nothing new and something new. I mean, I think partially there had become kind of a league of armchair Mueller watchers across the US over the last 2 years. They were tracking his every move. I remember someone writing something about a takeout order that part of his team had made at a hotel in Virginia a couple of years ago. I mean, people were really trying to get any detail they could out of this.
How you know media is becoming increasingly desperate.
Well, I mean, they were just so professional and they were so silent. They had their heads down. They were doing their work. 22 months this report took to come out. Mueller was someone who for 12 years was the head of the FBI. I mean, he's testified before Congress many, many times. And yet over the last 2 years, we've barely heard a word from him. So the fact that he came out this week seemed to be really significant, but he came out to basically say, here's the report and I'm going to restate parts of it. And yet the quote that the quote that he made seemed to also reignite the cycle of debate. I mean, he said...
Well, let's have a little listen to Mr. Mueller.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office.
I mean, he's choosing his words there, Elizabeth, with great deliberation.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of watchers are saying, well, that's Mueller speak for, at least in his words or in his way, I should say. If we thought that President Trump had not obstructed justice, that's what we would have said. And we haven't said that. So... ..
Well, indeed. And Bevan, the extraordinary... I mean, this to me is constantly underplayed in all this sort of search for conspiracy and collusion. But the fact stands, and Mueller says this, that Russia turned the American election in 2016.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello?
Absolutely, which, you know, the hunt for Trump has been so big that that's been almost... swept aside. Russia had a hand here. And Australia actually has skin in the game on this as well, because...
Joe Hockey.
Alexander Downer. Yes. You know, Trump himself said this week, I am getting my Attorney General, Andrew Barr, to look at this big conspiracy that we think happened to launch this investigation. And he named Australia specifically, and that is a reference to Alexander Downer meeting George Papadopoulos for a few drinks. So that's going to be really interesting to see where that goes, because, you know, the right-wing commentators in the US, they're going very hard on this global conspiracy. If I'm not, and I don't know the answer. I don't know. You know, the Downer stuff is pretty interesting. And if this inquiry is public, if there's public hearings, if details are made public, we may not have been part of a conspiracy, but there could be some pretty awkward moments for Australia in that.
Alexander Downer, or Boy Mulcaster, as Bernard Keane at Crikey insists on calling you, which is my favourite reference, I think. Elizabeth, we're going to hear Donald Trump and your thoughts on his reaction after these words from Trump.
Robert Mueller should have never been chosen because he wanted the FBI job and he didn't get it. And the next day he was picked as special counsel.
He's waging a campaign against Mueller, Elizabeth.
He is. I mean, he's painting him as the person who came knocking on the White House door looking for a job and that he didn't get one and so spurned he became the special counsel. I think Steve Bannon came out this week and said that that wasn't true. He did pay a visit to the White House, but he certainly wasn't there asking for the job, according to Bannon. So, I mean, I don't know. I think in many ways this is sort of more of the same that we've seen over the last 5 or 6 weeks since the report first came out, which is Trump's tweeted, Fox News has raged, Democrats have now successfully, some of them, selectively kind of coming out and calling for impeachment, some tentatively, some not so, some not at all. I think the thing is that Mueller is basically saying, though, I'm withdrawing from public life. You can continue to have this debate without me. It's all there in the
report.
My
job is done.
Yeah. Mm. But I mean, are we in a place and a space where we can pass that report? I think that report in many ways has become a vessel for people on both sides of the aisle to see in it what they wish to see, nothing, something, somewhere in between. And so, you know, I think the only real kind of thing to hold on to here is that it's going to follow Trump for longer than the 2 years that it's already dogged his presidency. And that's, you know, it's not a good thing for Trump. It's not a good thing.
I think the jury is out on that, on whether the people who voted for Trump and Trump will need to vote for him again the next election even care about this. You know, we're very excited about it. There's some people in America very excited about it. I think it's an open question whether or not this hurts him at all at the next election.
Well, this is the great hazard, of course, in talk of impeachment as well. And somebody, I can't think who, but this week was making, I think, the very good point of building the political case for that before that actually takes place. And as you suggest, Bevan, that political case around the entire Mueller probe is not yet made, and especially amongst Trump's heartland. And you would imagine that impeachment would simply inflame that heartland and, well, we create a very difficult political situation.
Yep.
We're looking at stories of the week, of which that was one on Drive. Bevan Shields is with us, Canberra Bureau Chief of The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, and Elizabeth Coulis from the fabulous Monthly's 7am podcast. Your thoughts are welcome. 0418 226 576. Bevan. I can't actually do an Alan Jones impression. I was toying in my mind with the possibility of giving that a crack, but I
best
can't.
Not.
I'm
best
sorry.
Not.
Alan Jones has re-signed with Sydney broadcaster 2GB.
He has, and I think this was a big story this week, and maybe in the sense that, you know, we'll be hearing about it and him for the next 2 years. So there had been some thought that maybe 2GB might say, we've had enough of Alan Jones and we're prepared to punt him. At the same time, Alan wasn't desperate to stay by the looks of things. He was prepared to walk if he needed to. Both sides have got together. They've signed a 2-year contract. I think it's about $4 million a year. So he's...
Sorry, just walk that figure past me.
That's
again.
Right. Yeah, what's that work out a week? I did do that calculation on my desk the other day and I sort of keeled over. But look, you know, love him or loathe him, and there are a lot of people on both sides of that fence. You just can't dispute that he is a very, very big figure in media, politics, business, sporting world in Australia. And the other uncomfortable fact is that he's a huge success. And clearly
very comfortable for him. I'm
clearly
sure.
Macquarie agrees because they're paying him $4 million a year, and they've done what it takes to keep him. Despite these, you know, various controversies,
and he has some acumen. I mean, he predicted rare in the Australian media firmament that the coalition would win the last election.
I was watching Sky that night, and he said, "There's no way Labor can win." And I'm happy to concede that I made a joke of that on Twitter and said, oh, well, Alan says that, we can all pack up and go home. And he was right. He was absolutely right.
See, what I want to know, Elizabeth, about Alan Jones is, does he dress that impeccably for his radio shift?
Well, I wondered that too when I saw him on Q&A in his amazing suit. But I also need to ask him about salary negotiation, because I'm not getting anything near that on my podcast. And I know my medium's catching up to the radio, but I'm hoping it'll go there.
I think he would have tips for us all. All right, Elizabeth, the moment is now. We can speak of the Uluru Statement of the Heart. It's a bit of a push on. And perhaps we should walk through some of the history here, because this was an extraordinary convocation of Indigenous people to come together to resolve on this statement, which then heartbreakingly was turfed aside by the Turnbull government amidst all sorts of ridiculous fears about third chambers and assaults on democracy. Yep. The work has continued. The people behind that statement are not to be denied on this and are looking at frameworks for potential recognitions and so forth. And there's still public impetus around that idea of constitutional recognition, at least.
Yeah, and I mean, this week it was not just the group around the Referendum Council and other supporters, but it was also media. I mean, Fairfax has been publishing material all week in support of the Statement from the Heart. The business sector's come out, all kinds of universities, sporting codes, I think the NRL, law firms, financial institutions, and so I think really there is a gathering conversation around this that goes much wider than the 250 delegates that drafted that statement in 2017. And I think you're right. I mean, I think the constitutional recognition of our First Nations peoples is not the same thing as a third chamber to parliament. And we need to have a nuanced and in-depth conversation about this and do the best we can, I think, to bring it to a referendum whenever possible.
I suspect, Bevan, that I don't know. I think I feel this as a settler Australian, but in the people that I talk with and the things that I read, there's a growing curiosity, if nothing more, about the past of this place and a quiet desire to resolve its history so that we can actually, as a people, go forward.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's been a quiet shift over quite a few years now. There hasn't been a moment, I don't think. I think the shift and that curiosity, as you point to, was happening even before the Uluru Statement, probably. Mm. Things like Ken White's appointment help. This, as Elizabeth said, this is a campaign being driven by the Sydney Morning Herald. Our editor, Lisa Davies, feels very strongly about it. The other reason we're really talking about it is that we have Scott Morrison as the Prime Minister and not Malcolm Turnbull, because Malcolm Turnbull basically came out very quickly and said, this is not happening. This is not happening under me. It won't happen. Scott Morrison's been a lot more nuanced than that and said he's committed to getting an outcome. We don't know what the outcome is and we don't know how long that would take, but he's far more open-minded about it. And the risk, you know, the nuanced campaign worries me a little bit, because we've seen in the election, we've seen in other national campaigns that sometimes nuance is lost, and
it's a tricky thing in public
would
life.
It is a complex thing to explain to people. And I fear that if it's rushed and if people don't do, a proper sales job of this, if it was to be defeated, that would be devastating and it would set back the cause decades.
I think that's Ken Wyatt's view too. Your thoughts on this in a sec, Elizabeth, but let's just hear Ken Wyatt first.
If we go in with something that we think is the right set of wording and we lose it, then it probably is relegated back to the past for another 30, 40 years.
There's a tricky balance there, isn't there, Elizabeth, between doing something and spoiling an opportunity?
I mean, that's true. That is true. I think we haven't seen a referendum, though, for quite some time. And we also know that, you know, from people who are travelling around with this remarkable document, a legal document, but also surrounded by an artwork, there's, I think, now more than 100,000 people who've met with this document as it travelled around the country over the last 18 months. And the reception that that document gets from anybody who does get a chance to sit with it and hear about what it is actually proposing in some detail, even if there are certain details that only our government can sort out, the proposal is really compelling. And the people who've travelled with that document say that at length. So I think Bevan's right. I hope we do continue to have a detailed conversation about it. And I think he's correct that it needs to be a purposeful discussion and a meaningful and detailed one. But I'm thinking this week about something that Stan Grant wrote on this. And I think he said, people historically locked out of this democracy are saying they want in. What a profound statement of faith in our country that a people for whom the Constitution was written to exclude were saying that that same Constitution can hold their dreams. When you look at it,
that's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's beautifully written, and I think there are lots of statements like that, not just in the document but around it, that if you do get a chance to look at it more closely are incredibly compelling as an Australian.
And I wonder if it's, Bevan mentioned the group of corporate and more broadly public interests getting around this idea, and it reminded me a little of Matt Canavan having a swing at the resources industry for, buckling on the idea of carbon, of climate change. I mean, is Elizabeth, one of those instances of public sentiment just being just way ahead of what's politically possible, or at least what's part of that sort of that narrow political agenda?
I mean, in my personal opinion, yes, I agree with that. I think my hope now is that our current politics can meet what that statement, what I think and my interpretation of kind of where Australia is at, both, as you say, the business and corporate community, but also the general population. I hope we can be met there with our politics.
Elizabeth Corliss is host of the 7am podcast. Bevan Shields is the Canberra Bureau Chief for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. We have been wrapping the week, which traditionally ends with a recommendation or two. One each, and we'll make two. Elizabeth, what should we do with ourselves this weekend in the cold and new winter?
So I did this last weekend, but I'm going to repeat myself again this weekend because it was so good. I'm going to be watching season 2 of Fleabag, which is streaming on Amazon right now. Have either of you seen it?
No,
but I hear it's a tad triggering.
Well, I guess that is true, and I suppose that should be. But I was actually going to say it's perfection, but certainly there might be some triggering material in there. It's just some of the most amazing TV writing I've seen in the last few years. I will talk to anybody who will listen about it at the moment.
Well, that's a pretty high bar in TV writing the last few years. Why so perfection?
So it's written by this British comedian, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She spun the first season out from her 2013 Edinburgh Festival show, and it was a great season, 6 episodes, and then she's come back and done this second season, and it is just such a brilliant end to the idea. And essentially that's it. It's going to be these 12 episodes, these last 6 episodes, that's the end of it. And it's heartbreaking in the fact that that's the full stop, but it ends so amazingly well that you're just grateful to her for the experience. There's incredible casting. The characters are sketched so beautifully, and then they're rendered in detail over these 6 half-hour episodes. There's amazing character development, and it can just swing from this kind of incredibly achingly dark humour to some moment of levity, and there's humour in between at every point. Well, like, just watch,
Can I say how glad I am that there's something wonderful that only goes for 2 seasons?
It breaks your heart a little bit, but you're just pleased that there's an end point. You can follow it through and it lands. It's like a gymnast just landing it. It's perfect.
Bevan?
Well, mine's also TV, sorry. I'm going to be watching a Joanna Lumley documentary.
Of course.
Because I absolutely love her, bordering on obsession. She is such a tremendous documentary maker. So I've gone old school and I've actually bought a DVD, which I can't remember the last time I bought a DVD. It's her, she's traveling around Japan over 4 episodes. Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain, but, you work so hard all week, your mind's racing, sitting down on the weekend and just pure escapism, going somewhere else and, being taken there by someone that you really idolise and love is so good, and I'm really looking forward to it.
There you go. Joanna Lumley and or Fleabag. The choice, dear listener, is yours for your weekend's entertainment. Look, thank you to our rappers this evening, Bevan Shields, Canberra Bureau Chief for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, Elizabeth Corliss, host of the 7am podcast. She'll be up bright and early, 3am on Monday, making the new one.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Well wrapped, you two.
Thank you.
This is RN Drive.